From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The priority today is fighting fires and evacuating, getting people to safety.
That's Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who's been criticised, as you'll hear, for his response to the country's ongoing and incredible fire crisis. More than 200 fires are burning, many in the country's most populous states, Victoria and New South Wales, which has declared a state of emergency. At least 17 people have been killed, more than 1,400 homes destroyed over months. Tourists have been forced into the sea, millions of animals killed. Koala bears are climbing up on bicycles to drink from riders' water bottles. And conditions are expected to worsen this weekend as the summer season kicks in. Our next guest got a call from her sobbing elderly father trapped in a steel shed on his property. She was able to tweet to fire services who rescued him just before that shed burned to the ground. How frightening. Carol Duncan is a city councillor in Newcastle in New South Wales. Also a former broadcaster with Australian Broadcasting Corporation. She's in Melbourne now. And Carol, so sorry your father had that experience. And this was before, by the way, your summer even started.
Yeah, that's nearly 3 months ago. And my father was actually very lucky to survive in those fires. Yeah. And two of their friends died in those fires.
Just terrible. And can you just describe for me some of the things you're seeing when the television's on? We see snippets here, and it's astonishing. What are you seeing?
I think what a lot of Australians are seeing at the moment is basically the eastern seaboard of this continent on fire. We are seeing images that we've seen before, but we haven't seen them on this scale. So it is now so big that I think people feel helpless and powerless. It is so big that they don't know how to truly comprehend the significance of this. But the Deputy Commissioner of the Rural Fire Service, Rob Rogers, said that if we had 10,000 firefighters, we still wouldn't be able to put these fires out. Another one of the conversations, and this is something I think we've talked about over the years as well, you know, in the future, wars will be fought over fuel or petrol or water. We're seeing in one small town on the south coast of New South Wales, Maruya, people queuing up and actually fighting to try and get into a supermarket to get food. So there, at the moment, roads are cut. We can't get water in. We can't get food and fresh groceries and things in. There is another town in Inverell in northern New South Wales where the locals have actually parked their cars to blockade a water supply so that the water carters, they have been accusing another town of coming in and filling up their massive water carting trucks to go and fill up people's swimming pools. So I think we're at a really horrible tipping point. And what we're seeing now, which has also really blown up over the last few days, I guess, in particular of this bushfire crisis in Australia, is that people who previously haven't been talking about the effect of climate change are starting to not just talk about it, but demand action on it.
Well, that includes your own government, because they've faced a lot of criticism. Your prime minister left and went on a vacation, but he's also virulently anti the thinking that there is a climate crisis. People in his administration have actually name-called people who want to talk about climate change. I mean, how are people reacting to that? And he seems to have suddenly recently been raising the question of, well, maybe this does have something to do with climate change.
I am not sure how seriously he may be taking that or paying lip service, but I think a lot of Australians are very, very angry at the Prime Minister and the government. And you mentioned, you know, that one of the comments from the man who was the acting Prime Minister while our PM went to Hawaii over Christmas referred to people who were concerned about climate change as raving inner city lefty lunatics or some such thing. And, you know, I'm afraid that now that's actually, well, I'm not afraid, I'm glad. It's actually mums and dads and people who've maybe been going, oh, yeah, I don't know about this climate change thing, are starting to actually see, most horrifically in this particular event, what that means. And there's still a lot of fighting going on social media about climate change doesn't start fires. Well, no, it doesn't. But we have been told for decades now that it will make these sorts of events bigger, more severe. In April of last year, more than 20 of Australia's former fire and emergency chiefs from multiple states and territories, these are very, very senior former fire and emergency officials warned the government to do something. They said that Australia was unprepared for worsening natural disasters from climate change and that governments are putting lives at risk. I suspect when the coronial hearings and inquiry start at some point after this disaster, that group and the coroner are going to be asking some very, very tough questions.
Coronial hearings, hearings into the deaths. Wow. And by the way, just to underscore what you just said, your Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has said, I'm not going to write off the jobs of thousands of Australians by walking away from traditional industries like coal, which, of course, produces the emissions that's producing the extreme weather situations that we're seeing. Yeah.
This is the man who took a lump of coal into the federal parliament.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say, actually, the city of Newcastle, where I come from, is the world's largest coal export port. So in my home city and my home region of the Hunter Valley, it is a coal mining region. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are demanding for an instant shutdown to coal exports and so on. And, of course, that's, you know, this nation's economy needs those exports. So that's going to be an incredibly difficult and vexed conversation for us to, and for something to actually handle actively into the future, to make sure that we really do produce a just transition for those many, many communities around Australia who rely on coal mining, you know, because we can't just turn it off. We would devastate families, we'd devastate communities and the economy.
That's Carol Duncan, city councillor in Newcastle in New South Wales, former broadcaster with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Carol, we have sympathy for your dad. He lost his home, his cattle, escaped with the clothing on his back, as that cliched phrase goes. So sorry about that. And we wish you and your family and everyone there the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to Baton Rouge, where authorities today announced an arrest and the killings of three homeless people in recent weeks. Here's Police Chief Murphy Paul at a press conference earlier.
We arrested Jeremy Anderson. He has been charged with two counts of first-degree murder. Two counts of, let me make sure I got this right. Give me the charges again. Two counts of first-degree murder and one count of second-degree murder.
Jacqueline DeRobertis has been covering this story for The Advocate in Baton Rouge. And Jacqueline, this suspect, Jeremy Anderson, is 29 years old. What more do we know about the arrest, how authorities found him, and the potential motive?
He was arrested blocks away from where the shootings happened. Apparently, the East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department received a tip from somebody this week, and they passed it on to investigators at the police, and they were able to make an arrest quickly.
Tell us a little bit more about the three people who were killed and the circumstances.
Sure. Christina Fowler, she was 53 years old, and she was found huddled in blankets next to Gregory Corcoran, who's 40. Christina Fowler struggled from a lifelong drug addiction, according to her family, and she was struggling to find a place to stay. Gregory Corcoran, according to his sister, had fallen on hard times, and he was traveling from Texas to Florida, where he had a job opportunity lined up. You know, he leaves behind four children under the age of 18. And Tony Williams, he's 50 years old. We don't really know much about him at this point. His homicides are so recent, but he was found 2 days after Christmas on the front porch of an abandoned house.
Yeah, I know there have been lots of efforts to get homeless people to safety before this arrest, encouraging them to go to shelters and beefing up police presence at homeless encampments. You know, homeless people are disproportionately the victims of violent crimes in this nation overall. Did police talk about, if anything, what will change in those efforts to keep homeless people safe there?
Yeah, so, you know, not necessarily what is going to change, but the efforts that have been done to really raise awareness about this particular problem. And, you know, leaders emphasize that even though these people were homeless and sort of exist on the margins of society, their deaths are important. Their lives were important. You know, recently the city was able to fund an improvement to one of the shelters around here that's going to open 36 additional beds. And they made sure to point that out, that hopefully if something like this happens again, there will be room for people to stay and get off the streets.
And, you know, there's often been a contentious relationship with law enforcement and homeless populations. But give us the timeline very quickly between the shootings and then when this arrest happened. It seemed to happen pretty quickly.
Yes. So the first incident happened on December 13th, and then the second incident happened 2 weeks later. A press conference was held Friday announcing that police believed the killings were connected, and we already have an arrest today. So it was actually pretty quick. The police formed a task force, bringing in community partners, local law enforcement, and really going on the ground to talk to homeless providers to try to get the word out and to try to ask if anyone noticed anything suspicious. I understand that they've increased patrols in the area, and despite that contentious relationship you mentioned, I know that officers on the ground in the area frequently were really making efforts to reach out to the people on the ground and really talk to them and try to inform them about the dangers of being in this environment while, you know, these potentially targeted killings were happening.
Jacqueline DeRobertis covers crime for The Advocate in Baton Rouge.
Some recent events caught our eye: the attempted attack on the American embassy in Iraq, and the reporting last week that not only did President Trump's personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani interfere in policy in Ukraine, he was part of a move to intercede in Venezuela. Well, both reminded us of the late 1970s, when David Rockefeller, heir to the Standard Oil fortune and head of Chase Bank, also conducted shadow diplomacy to convince a reluctant President Jimmy Carter to bring the Shah of Iran, deposed in the 1979 revolution, to the U.S. Now, Carter's decision would prompt angry Iranians who wanted the Shah tried for corruption to attack the U.S. embassy in Tehran and take 52 hostages for 444 days through the next American election, which Carter lost to Ronald Reagan. Carter perhaps oblivious as to who was pulling the strings behind the scenes. Terrence Smith, then a rising star at the New York Times, wrote about those puppet masters in a 1981 piece. And now, nearly 40 years later, the Times' David Kirkpatrick uses Rockefeller's private minutes to corroborate much of what Smith wrote, that an old boys' club was running the show. Terrence Smith, now retired from the New York Times, joins us from Annapolis. Terry, welcome.
Thank you.
What did you think when you saw this deeper reporting on something that you had this by the tail back in 81? Joe Reed, the chief of staff to then Chase Bank chair David Rockefeller, saying things like the eagle has landed when they successfully brought the Shah into the United States.
Well, it was absolutely haunting to read it, because here were the notes, the actual documents, the notes that they took during a real campaign to persuade President Carter to admit the Shah to the United States, a decision he had resisted and did not want to do, out of both concern for the diplomats in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and for broader reasons. But David Rockefeller was a great friend and supporter of the Shah of Iran, along with Henry Kissinger and John J. McCloy. And so they had their own agenda, as you say, their own foreign policy, if you like, which was to persuade President Carter to admit the Shah. And so they mounted quite a campaign to do it.
Well, he had an affection for the Shah. And by the way, David Rockefeller says that's all this was. There were many on the conservative side who felt the U.S. shouldn't abandon an ally. When you said Carter had other considerations, one of them was to try to forge some kind of relationship with the new government in Iran for the benefit of the country, knowing that if the Shah came to the United States, that would not happen. That was a big concern. David Rockefeller would deny this, but there are some who suspected it was because Chase Bank stood to benefit. The Shah had a lot of money. Chase wanted him and his money safe in the U.S.
Well, it was a fact that the Chase Manhattan Bank, David Rockefeller's bank, had very close and very profitable relations with Iran when the Shah was on the throne. In fact, by 1979, the bank had syndicated more than $1.7 billion in loans for Iranian public projects. And that's the equivalent of maybe $5.8 to $6 billion today. So as they say in Washington, there was real money involved.
Yeah. And the Shah had been put into position by U.S. and other interests. And then you have in 1978 this huge uprising against him, millions of Iranians protesting in the streets. They want him gone. Here's an ABC report from December 30th, 1978.
The old chant of death to the Shah was replaced today by a new one, death to Carter. There is still a strong sentiment against American interests in Iran and the widespread belief that the United States has taken the profits from Iranian oil.
And this is, of course, what Jimmy Carter felt he had to overcome.
Exactly right. And you're right, Robin, that President Carter did want to try to establish relations and a relationship with the new leaders in Iran in order to sustain that alliance, which had been so important in the region for so long. Mm-hmm. So he had reasons not to let the Shah in to the United States. And the Shah, remember, had gone on this odyssey. Henry Kissinger at the time called him the Flying Dutchman, mm-hmm. traveling to Egypt and the Bahamas and Mexico, trying to find, in effect, a place to land with his family and a small coterie of supporters. And yet here were David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, John J. McCloy, who'd been an attorney for the Shah, all pressuring President Carter through indirect means to do what he didn't want to do, which was admit the Shah to the United States. And that's why the outbreak and violence in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad in the last couple of days is so haunting, because it's almost a carbon copy of what happened in Tehran, actually 9 months before the hostages were taken, and then again when the hostages were taken.
Because there had been an attack on the U.S. embassy 9 months before, and hostages were taken, but a negotiation occurred, they were released, and then this far more meaningful hostage taking took place just after the Shah came into the United States.
Exactly right. 2 weeks later, this is the way the Iranians responded.
So the way that the Shah gets into the United States, the way you painted in your 1981 article, is that this coterie of people backing the Shah, including the Rockefellers at Chase Bank, relayed a message to Jimmy Carter that the Shah is much sicker than he really is. He is sick, and that a U.S. hospital would be the only place to treat him. It sounds like they lied to Carter.
Well, Carter was certainly misinformed. There's no question about that. In January of 1981, when he was no longer president, I went down and interviewed him on this very question. Sitting in his living room in Plains, I asked him why he had admitted the Shah, a decision that ultimately cost him the presidency. And he said, well, I was told that he was close to death and that the Shah needed to come to New York for medical treatment, and that New York was the only place where he could get this. I had interviewed Dr. Benjamin Keene, who had examined the Shah, and knew firsthand that that was not true. So I said to the president, you know that's not correct, that he was not at the point of death, and New York was not the only facility that could save him. In fact, the work that needed to be done could have been done anywhere, including in Mexico, where he was. Well, the president got very agitated at that point and insisted vehemently to me that that's what he had been told. And I don't doubt him for a minute.
Well, and the result was the hostage taking saw the rise of Ronald Reagan. In fact, Jimmy Carter worked every single second right up till the moment, I think, that Ronald Reagan was standing on the inaugural platform to get the hostages released. Carter did get them released. Reagan took credit. Have I got that right?
That is correct. That happened on the day that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated president.
Yeah.
And what these latest papers show you from Joseph Reed, they show you that Rockefeller and his people were working very closely with the Reagan administration. He was, after all, a Republican. And they were working very closely with the Reagan campaign to avoid what they called an October surprise. In other words, the release of the hostages immediately before the election, which probably would have put Carter over the top.
Right. Instead, they held off on that. The new documents reveal the Chase team helped the Reagan campaign spread rumors about Carter paying Iranians for the hostages, which outraged Americans, and Carter's people said delayed talks on the release. And it's not just that, Terry. We're reminded that it's been the fraught relations since, I mean, that bring us right to this week's attacks by Iranian-backed militia members and protesters on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. I mean, it's really a stunning through line. But as you watch reports of this shadow foreign diplomacy being run today, you know, there are supporters of President Trump who are saying, look, it's no big deal. It's happened forever. The difference is that President Trump doesn't hide it, sends his personal lawyer around the world to try to gin up investigations. Your thoughts on that?
Right. I would argue this is much more direct. This is the president's personal lawyer, as you said, Rudy Giuliani, taking an active role to try to bring about events that would, he hoped, help President Trump in his reelection and damage his presumed opponent, Joe Biden. So this is much more direct.
President Carter resisted and didn't know how much he was being misled.
Absolutely did not know it. Insisted that he was told what he was told. And that's why he did what he did. So this, I would argue, today is a much more blatant and out front, obvious manipulation by, in this case, the president's personal lawyer, than what you had before was positively subtle and gentlemanly by comparison.
But I guess overall, it just seems to be a reminder of why shadow diplomacy may not, you know, shadow citizen diplomacy just may not be a good idea.
Not at all. And as you say, it's not new.
Yeah. Terrence Smith, the New York Times legend who wrote this story, Why Carter Admitted the Shah, more than 40 years ago. We're revisiting it thanks to some new documents and new reporting. We'll link you to all of it at herenow.org. Terry, thanks so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
The Trump administration is planning to ban all flavored e-cigarette cartridges except menthol and tobacco flavors in an effort to reduce the number of teenagers who vape. The president's also signed a new law banning e-cigarette and tobacco product sales to anyone under 21 years old. But corporations are also taking a stand. Beginning February 1st, the latest is U-Haul. They're planning to stop hiring people who vape or smoke cigarettes or use any other form of nicotine. The company, based in Phoenix, Arizona, has about 30,000 employees across the U.S. and Canada. And the nicotine-free policy will apply in 21 states where it is legal for companies to not hire people who use nicotine. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, has taken a look at this. And Robin, we should say that this isn't going to apply to existing employees. They're grandfathered, but these are new employees. They're not going to hire them if they smoke. Why are they saying that they want to do this?
Well, the flowery PR line is a responsible step. This is in fostering a culture of wellness with the goal of helping our team members on their health journey. But you can quickly cut through that to understand that no smoking or vaping breaks at this company going forward means more time working. And you look at rising health care costs at a company of 30,000. In theory, at least, you can counter that by hiring new non-smokers. That finally puts a dent into those costs.
Well, but we also have to give them some cred because they have these much heralded workout facilities, you know, in Phoenix. I mean, they do seem to care about their people working well. Because on the other side of the equation, it's good for the bottom line, your company's bottom line, if your people are healthy. We wondered if it had anything to do with, you know, it's uncomfortable to be around sometimes to be around people who smoke, but you're saying it's mostly, you feel mostly bottom line.
Not only bottom line, but it's true for non-smokers as well. I mean, you look at the CDC numbers. They say smoking-related illness costs the U.S. more than $300 billion each year. Within that, there's more than $156 billion in lost productivity, including $6 billion due to secondhand smoke exposure. And if you want to drill down on the bottom line, WalletHub calculated that smoking and exposure to secondhand smoke cost the U.S. more than $1.9 million over the lifetime of each smoker. So those numbers are really, really tangible.
Yeah. But can they do this? I mean, obviously they are, and other companies have, and they're doing it in states where it is legal for companies to just not hire people who smoke, but smoking is legal.
Yeah, it's interesting to plumb what the ACLU and other civil libertarians say about this. Of course, your health insurance covers you 24/7. It's not prorated for when you do and don't introduce things into your body. The ACLU calls this slippery slope, quote, lifestyle discrimination, and it even offers a legislative briefing kit on lifestyle discrimination. You get into nanny state implications and what if you discriminate against overweight people or older people who are prone to diseases? We do know that two states have already passed comprehensive laws against what the ACLU calls lifestyle discrimination. The goal for the ACLU is enactment in every state of statutes that, quote, protect all working Americans from discrimination based on their off-duty activities.
Yeah, well, speaking of which, as of yesterday, recreational marijuana use became legal in Illinois. So now there's 11 states plus D.C., that allow legal use of cannabis. And, you know, that's recreational use. That's in your own time. Companies can test for drugs in the system when you work. But here they are banning employees who smoke.
That's right. And drug tests are still fairly ubiquitous, Robin. You see them spelled out clearly in the terms of your employment. So, yes, of course, you're free to fly out to Chicago and binge on deep dish pizza and marijuana. But remember your HR terms of agreement.
Yeah. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you, as always.
Happy New Year.
Oh, you too.
There's an iconic scene in E.T. when Elliot is in biology class and makes a split-second decision to free the frogs. It's a rite of passage for many of us. We learn about organ systems by dissecting preserved frogs bathed in formaldehyde, a potentially hazardous chemical. Well, in Florida, veterinarian David Danielson has teamed up with J.W. Mitchell High School in New Port Richey, Florida, to find a better way. Jessica Schultz is the school's principal. She joins us on Skype, along with 12th grader Nabil Coney Laye. Thank you both for joining us.
You're welcome. We're happy to be here.
Hi, how are you?
And just to let listeners know, it is a school day, so we might be hearing bells ringing. But Principal Schultz, I first want to start with you. Your school is the first to adopt the world's first man-made synthetic frog. What appealed to you about making this switch?
So Dr. Danielson is my personal vet, and he sees all of my animals. And 3 years ago, he and I started talking about that after his daughter had come home from biology and didn't want to dissect. And he said, if we were to develop something, would you all be willing to do that? And I said, absolutely. So he started talking through what his company was going to be doing. And we had a great opportunity to help them go through the Florida standards so that they made sure that what they were designing for students would be something relevant and continuously be rigorous.
I want to get to the actual frog and some of the design elements of this frog. But I have a question for you. I've always wondered where schools get their animals from to dissect. Where were you getting your frogs from before these synthetic frogs? And really, how many were you using in any given year?
So we get our frogs from any kind of scientific supply company. I would venture to guess that we probably use 200 to 300 frogs a year. The biggest issue with it is that it's a superior device because of the fact that when you cut it open, you have to cut the breastbone of the synthetic frog just as hard and put as much pressure as you would on a regular frog. In a regular frog that is deceased, if it is a female frog, the egg sac might have broken. So a lot of times when students go in, they have to spend some time cleaning out all of the debris from that. In this frog, that's not the case.
Nabil, you're a 12th grader and you have dissected a real animal before. What's it like handling these synthetic frogs?
So my ninth grade year, I did the pigs with the formaldehyde, and they were alive, of course. And the one thing I could really remember about that experience is the smell. And when I was dissecting these synthetic frogs, it just wasn't there. And I was kind of surprised at first, you know, but it smelled just like it was a normal classroom.
What about the feel? Did it feel like it was that it was real?
Yeah, I touched it and it was, you know, it was wet and slimy. And then when you touched the inside, it had the same consistency as an actual frog.
Principal Schultz, I'm really interested, though, in the cost of this. How do you preserve these synthetic frogs? How do you take care of it? And how much does it cost compared to these real frogs that you've been using for so many years?
Right now, it's $150 a frog. They are consumable. So in education lingo, that means that they would be a one-time use. However, the expectation is that they can recycle the frog. So if once a student is finished with the frog, we gather them up and we send them back to the company and they complete whatever process they complete and they create new frogs for them.
Nabil, I played the clip earlier of E.T. You're probably pretty young. Do you know the movie E.T.?
I'm familiar with it. Yes, thank you.
Okay. Well, we played the clip at the top of this segment with Elliot trying to free the frogs. And I remember when I was in biology class, just feeling some kind of way about cutting through an animal, even though it was already dead, knowing that I was just a part of something that was being used just for this sole purpose. I mean, are you an animal lover? Do you think about this? Have your classmates talked about this and how this actually changes the dynamic of biology classes?
So one thing that I think is important to note about the frog dissection is that it's purely for educational purposes. It's not to see who's going to become a surgeon or a doctor. So when you bring these synthetic frogs into the actual classroom, nobody's going to be off-put by the fact that it was alive because it's, you know, synthetic, of course. So I think that reduces some of the barriers for some of the other students in the classroom.
That's 12th grader Nabil Konilaye of J.W. Mitchell High School and Principal Jessica Schultz discussing the use of the first synthetic frog used for high school dissection. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To Colorado now, where a discovery of fossils has opened a window into an evolutionary period we didn't know much about. Allie Butner from member station KRCC in Colorado Springs has more on this story from the two scientists who published their findings in the journal Science.
Microscopes, plaster casts, and the sound of small drilling machines fill the fossil labs at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. Paleontologist Tyler Leeson picks up a bowling ball-sized rock and points to the fossilized bones embedded in one side of it.
This is one of several crocodiles that we found at Corral Bluffs.
Corral Bluffs is a windswept, rocky outcropping just about 15 miles east of Colorado Springs.
It's just a series of these mudstones and giant sandstone types of rock, maybe 120 feet that rise into the air.
On a fall day back in 2016, Leeson was out there with his colleague Ian Miller. Miller specializes in plant fossils, and the two of them were trying to solve one of the biggest puzzles of evolution.
What was life like after the extinction of the dinosaurs?
Miller says we know that a mega asteroid hit the Earth 66 million years ago, killing off the dinosaurs, along with most of the species on the planet. But what he and Leeson wanted to figure out was how did life on Earth rebound after this mass extinction?
Nobody really had a great view into that world because we just didn't have the data. We didn't have the fossils.
That was about to change when Leeson examined a rock that day at Corral Bluffs.
He picked one up, broke it open, and you could see like both sides of a mammal skull on either side, sort of staring back at him. And I can remember he just sat down and started laughing, looking at us like, oh my God, like, is this really happening?
Miller says within the next half hour or so, they found five intact skulls, all from previously undiscovered species. They knew right then that they'd hit it big. Over the next couple of years, they found thousands of fossils of many plant and animal species new to science. And with all of this data, they started to piece together the story of what happened in the first 1 million years after the asteroid hit the Earth.
And this moment in time is so critical because it is the moment from which everything that lives on Earth today emerged.
That's a pretty big deal. So what did they find out? Well, buckle up. Miller and Leeson are going to steer us through.
We're hit by an asteroid. It's moving about 150,000 miles an hour.
From this devastated landscape, the Earth turns green again in a matter of years or decades.
The land explodes with ferns, then forests of palm trees start to flourish.
And here we see mammals start to rebound in terms of diversity, in terms of their numbers, as well as their size.
Now trees in the walnut family start to crop up.
Since the walnut family includes the pecans, we've named this the pecan pie world.
At 700,000 years after the asteroid struck Earth, the world's oldest legume, or bean pod, appears. This was one of Miller and Leeson's most prized discoveries at Corral Bluffs.
So we've dubbed this the protein bar moment.
Because of these new protein-rich food sources, mammals are now growing about 100 times bigger than the rat-sized survivors of the mass extinction. They're on their way to dominating the food chain.
That's the story in a nutshell, so to speak.
And what's cool, says Leeson, is that
it's such a remarkable discovery. It was right here in our backyard.
He says the story he and Miller have uncovered here near Colorado Springs opens a window into understanding what can happen to life after mass extinction. And that's relevant. Miller points out we're in the middle of another mass extinction of species right now, albeit more slow-moving than an asteroid.
We are the asteroid that's wiping out ecosystems and species today through a whole variety of processes.
He says their research does show how life has been resilient in the past and that it can come back after mass extinctions. But it comes back changed.
What you see outside today, if that goes extinct, it's extinct forever.
For now, he says, they'll keep studying the fossils from Corral Bluffs to learn as much as they can about how today's world came to be. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Budner.
And Allie's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
In 2019, a lot of parents had to decide, should they let their kids skip school to protest?
What do you want change? What do you want it now? What do you want change? I'm a change of the custom.
Remember last September when students from around the world joined one of the largest youth-led demonstrations ever against the climate crisis? Kids in 150 countries and all over 4,000 locations, including New York, Washington, San Francisco, skipped a day of school to participate in the global strike demanding governments address climate change. New York City allowed students an excuse day off with parental consent. And now one of the largest school districts in the country, Fairfax County, Virginia, says starting January 21st, it will let its students use one excused absence every year for any civic action they want to take. Fairfax School Board member Ryan McElveen is here. He's also an associate director of the China Center at the Brookings Institution. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's an honor to be with you.
Well, thank you. And let's cut to the chase, though. Critics of this day off say it's a liberal plot. When New York gave kids the day off and applauded them for their activism, the conservative New York Post wrote that it was an out-and-out government sponsorship of a particular liberal point of view. You say what?
I will tell you that when we adopted this policy in Fairfax County, we by no means meant for it to be political in any way. We wrote the language so that it would be completely neutral and that students from all walks of life could participate.
Well, I want to learn more about how it works and the thinking behind it. But staying with this idea that there are, you know, some critics, what if kids want the day off to go to a white supremacist march? You know, some people worry that this gets schools into the business of maybe of deciding what is a worthy or a safe protest they will then in some ways endorse by allowing kids to go.
What I would say is that Fairfax County has never endorsed nor opposed student activism that's taken place. Going forward, we do believe it's the role of education institutions to help students become productive. And I think giving them the opportunity during the school day to participate in an activity of civic engagement helps foster that.
Well, and that's how it's written. They can engage in an activity of civic engagement. What does that mean?
So as we think of civic engagement, and as I think of it personally, I would think it would include things like protests, sit-ins, going to Washington, D.C. or Richmond, Virginia, which is the capital of our state, to engage with legislators. And what we've seen over the past several years is just an astronomical rise in student activism and interest in various issues.
Including gun safety?
The top two issues that we've seen student interest in have been gun violence prevention and climate change. And really that rise of student activism really started in the aftermath of the Parkland incident. That's really what galvanized our board into looking at this policy language, because we had schools around our county and frankly around the nation that were handling it differently. And we wanted to make sure that all of our students had the same right to participation.
Right. So every school knew what the county policy would be. So how exactly does it work? There's some advance notice that has to happen, parental permission?
That's correct. So about 2 days in advance, students will have to submit a form identifying where they will be going to participate in civic engagement, and they will have to have parental permission to do so.
Now, this brings up some other questions. You know, back in the day, it was an act of defiance, you know, skipping school, suffering the consequences to stand up for something that you believed in, going to a protest. This is, you know, sort of the school kind of, you know, patting you on the head and saying, we will excuse this. Have you heard from any students? You know, I'm not sure I want my school to know where I'm going. It takes away from the act of defiance part of it.
Based on the responses I received from students, that is not a concern to them. They just want to make sure that they can have their voices heard and do so without being punished by the school system.
Well, again, given that there's going to be some sort of symbiosis now between a school and a protesting student, if the student is going to protest, fill in the blank, you know, something that maybe a majority of people at the school might find offensive, you are now locked into this, right? You can't have a say in what they protest.
That's correct. And, you know, again, our policy language is written so that the school system is not deciding what counts and what does not count.
Yeah.
And to be completely honest with you, we're in uncharted waters here. You know, someone has to take the first dive into the pool. And so I think that's what Fairfax County has done. And hopefully other school systems can learn from us.
Well, we're reminded by some reading on this that this would make a great social studies class because these young people have the right to protest. It's guaranteed in the First Amendment.
That's correct.
That's Fairfax School Board member Ryan McElveen. Well, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
Boy, I would love to know what people think. But Tanya, what about you? Would you sign that permission slip?
Oh, absolutely. My daughter wanted to be a part of the climate crisis march a few months back, and I was totally for it. I want her to have agency over her life.
There's that. People here are saying, wait, getting permission to go protest is like, what? But listeners, weigh in. We'd love to hear from you. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
Dangerous fire conditions are expected to continue into the weekend in Australia's most populous state, New South Wales, a state of emergency and a climate crisis as people scramble to flee the south coast. We'll have the latest next time on Here and Now.